Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, the Israeli defense minister suggests that major Palestinian protests, like those on Israel's borders May 15th, require new responses. But what, if anything, is new about U.S. media's approach to Palestinian protests and rights? Journalist Ali Abu Nima of Electronic Intifada will join us to talk about that. Also on the show, we'll play part of Glenn Greenwald's address at FAIR's recent 25th anniversary celebration at Symphony Space in New York City. The Salon writer shared his thoughts on the media with a standing room only crowd. He shared the stage with Amy Goodman, Noam Chomsky, and Michael Moore. We'll be bringing you some of Glenn Greenwald's remarks later on. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
On the May 15th Meet the Press, presidential hopeful Newt Gingrich talked about Boeing's planned relocation of some of its operation from Washington State to South Carolina, where the laws are considered anti-union. A Boeing official told the Seattle Times that the move was a response to previous union activity in Washington, making it a clear-cut violation of labor law, which says you can't retaliate against workers for lawful activity. It's a common industry practice to discourage organizing with threats of closure and outsourcing, but this time the National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB, has challenged it, which has conservatives up in arms. That includes Gingrich, who told Meet the Press anchor David Gregory the NLRB, quote, is basically breaking the law to try to punish Boeing and to threaten every right-to-work state, close quote. As labor reporter Mike Elk pointed out, and in these times, while Gregory vigorously challenged Newt Gingrich on details of his personal life, he failed to challenge him on this false assertion that the NLRB was breaking the law, despite the fact that the complaint against Boeing is entirely consistent with legal precedent. Gregory's failure is especially troubling, Elk noted, since Meet the Press is, as the show's website prominently boasts, sponsored by Boeing. This recalls when ABC's This Week was posting fact checks of guests appearing on their program, and Gregory said it was an interesting idea, but not for them because, quote, people can fact check Meet the Press every week on their own terms, close quote. Word to the wise.
USA Today had a piece on May 15th suggesting that the U.S. was exhibiting a double standard in its reactions to the democratization movement in the Arab world. Not, mind you, that the U.S. was condoning violent repression of pro-democracy demonstrations in U.S.-allied places like Bahrain, Yemen, and Saudi Arabia, but rather that it wasn't coming out strongly enough against an official enemy, Bashar Assad of Syria. The piece prominently quoted Tony Badrin of the Center for the Defense of Democracies, which was only described as a think tank in Washington. More completely, the center is a neoconservative advocacy group originally set up to defend Israeli repression of the Palestinian Intifada, led by people like Gingrich, Bill Kristol, Robert McFarlane, and Joe Lieberman. Without giving any clue to his group's agenda, USA Today cites Badrin seeing a double standard granted to an enemy of the United States because, compared with Syria's Assad, quote, Obama was much harder on the actions of former dictator Hosni Mubarak, where 300 people were killed in recent protests, Badrin says, close quote. In the case of Egypt, which he describes as an ally that kept peace with Israel for 30 years, Badrin says, you'd think you'd follow restraint. But, quote, we abandoned restraint and immediately embraced democracy. With an enemy, you're embracing restraint, close quote. So when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton declared that Mubarak should remain in office, and Vice President Biden said he shouldn't step down and was not a dictator, and the administration continued to send military aid to Egypt, even as the security forces were killing protesters, they were unrestrainedly embracing democracy. Which is just to say, the next time you hear from the Center for the Defense of Democracies, you might try and remember how they define the term.
PBS's NewsHour's Jim Lehrer has announced that he's stepping down from the show's anchor chair in June. Whether this will lead to improvements is undetermined. As Fair has documented for more than two decades, the NewsHour, while appearing to provide more in-depth and multifaceted views on events, has consistently failed to uphold the founding public broadcasting mission to be a forum for ideas and viewpoints often excluded from commercial media, the whole helping us see America whole in all its diversity thing. Instead, the NewsHour has replicated the elite bias of commercial newscasts, spotlighting powerful interests and sidelining other perspectives. Fair's most recent research in 2010 found that 44% of the show's guest list were government and military officials. Corporate representatives were 10%, and just 4% were those public interest voices the network was meant to give an airing to. Lehrer will still moderate Friday debate segments featuring conservative New York Times columnist David Brooks and affable centrist Mark Shields, exactly the sort of safe programming featuring views you can find anywhere that public media were meant to leave to others. Of course, the NewsHour's elite slant isn't entirely attributable to the person sitting in the anchor chair, but for viewers with hope for a public TV newscast that really is challenging and vital and diverse, Lehrer's exit makes an opening call for the show to move in that direction.
And speaking of public broadcasting, rare criticism of the medium occurred on PBS's own Tavis Smiley show on May 13th, when Smiley hosted retired PBS institution Bill Moyers. Smiley started the ball rolling, remarking that TV, including public television, rarely gives a venue to people who have refused to buy into the ruling ideology of Washington. He even singled out PBS for failing to live up to its founding mission. Moyers didn't disagree, elaborating on how Republicans from Richard Nixon to Newt Gingrich, with power over funding, had succeeded in narrowing public broadcasting politically with a relentless campaign of left-baiting. Said Moyers, the, quote, constant harassment creates a kind of caution and self-censorship on the part of people who just don't want to, you know, we don't get but about 17% of the total budget from the Congress, but that's enough to leave a big hole in what the local stations do if we don't have it, close quote. Moyers said the rights campaign has created an, quote, inevitable censorship that takes place on the part of people who are running the programs, booking the programs, lining up guests, to make sure that we don't give the right wing another opportunity to come in and accuse us of being liberal, close quote. Which explains a great deal about why PBS programs like the NewsHour look the way they do.
And finally, New York Times business reporter Andrew Ross Sorkin wrote an article on May 15th that tried to advance the argument that $250,000 actually isn't that much money to make in a year. The complaint is that politicians who advocate raising tax rates on income above $250,000 a year have chosen an arbitrary dividing line. Above it, you're rich, and you'll be taxed accordingly. Articles like this are annoying. We're being asked to listen to wealthy people complain that they're not that wealthy once you factor in the private school tuition and the mortgage on the big house. But they're often also misleading, especially when it comes to how much wealthy people pay in taxes. Ross Sorkin mentions a Manhattan father of two with a household income of $262,000 per year who sees his tax bill potentially going up and says, quote, I don't understand why people like us are lumped in with millionaires and billionaires, close quote. As economist Dean Baker pointed out, if you understand marginal tax rates, you should know that someone making slightly more than $250,000 per year would pay a higher rate only on the income above that amount, which in the case of the Manhattan father would mean a few hundred dollars at most in extra taxes. The article goes on to discuss tax policy and budget deficits, with Ross Sorkin making this point. Quote, much of the income of the country's wealthiest people comes from investments, which is taxed at the long-term capital gains rate of just 15%. So far, neither Democrats nor Republicans dare talk about raising the long-term capital gains tax out of fear that it would reduce crucial investments that could produce jobs, close quote. No one talks about raising capital gains tax rates. The Congressional Progressive Caucus's blueprint, the People's Budget, offers an array of options for raising revenues, including eliminating preferentially low rates on long-term capital gains. So someone is talking about it after all. Part of Ross Sorkin's point is that more tax brackets would help clarify the difference between earning a mere $250,000 or, say, many millions of dollars. a fine idea and also part of the people's budget. If reporters gave it more attention, they might discover that some of the answers they pretend to seek are staring them in the face.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The 63rd anniversary of the Nakba, the expulsion and flight of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians that accompanied the creation of the Israeli state, was marked by coordinated protests at borders with Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon. At one protest alone, 10 Palestinians were killed and 115 wounded. Coincident with a major speech from Obama meant to define U.S. interests in the Mideast, the protests have put the region and its history back in the spotlight. But is there anything new in the way U.S. media are approaching the story? We're joined now by phone by Ali Abu Nima, journalist and founder and executive director of the website Electronic Intifada. Welcome back to Counterspin, Ali Abu Nima.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, let's talk about history a bit first. It's a tenet, if you will, of U.S. coverage of Israeli-Palestinian strife that the violence begins with Palestinian actions to which Israel provoked retaliates. A recent New York Times story suggests that that rule is retroactive. In providing context for the May 15th demonstrations, Ethan Bronner writes, quote, "After Israel declared independence on May 15, 1948, armies from neighboring Arab states attacked the new nation. During the war that followed, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians fled or were driven from their homes by Israeli forces. Hundreds of Palestinian villages were also destroyed," close quote. For those unversed in the history of the region, this is not how historians, including Israeli historians, present that period, correct?
Absolutely not. What Ethan Bronner has done there is falsified the history and reversed the chronology, because the way he has it, you know, Israel was declared and then Arab armies attack, and then you have refugees, some of whom may have been driven out by Israel. But, you know, it's the same old storyline of the Arabs started it and Israel was responding. The reality and the chronology, which is not disputed by historians at all, is that the expulsions of Palestinians began in late 1947. And by May 15th, 1948, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians had already been driven from their homes all around the country, and in many cases by terrorist bombings by the Zionist militias like the Irgun, the Stern Gang, and others. This is, as we said, well documented by Israeli and other historians, but also by the New York Times itself, which, you know, you can go back to its reporting from the period in the late 1940s. So, ironically, in a way, the New York Times is fabricating history or denying history that was reported on its own pages in order to produce this politically palatable narrative that exonerates Israel for responsibility for what's happened to Palestinian refugees.
Well, other variants on that seem to be NBC's Richard Engel, for example, who said on the Today Show that Nakba means catastrophe, quote, which is how many Palestinians describe the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, close quote. That seems to have an inexactitude to it that fits well with the assertion that these protests were about the very existence of Israel.
Exactly. And it casts the Palestinians as being somehow unreasonable and anti-Semitic and sort of inexplicably hostile. Of course, the catastrophe is what was sort of partly acknowledged in Ethan Bronner's language, the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians and the destruction of 500 villages, towns and cities. That is the catastrophe. I think it would be a bit like, you know, saying that Native Americans view the creation of the United States as a catastrophe, without acknowledging that the creation of the United States entailed the destruction of, you know, Native American populations and communities that had existed here for centuries.
Well, let's come up to the present day. A Washington Post story quoted Israel's defense minister Ehud Barak saying, quote, the Palestinians' transition from suicide bomber terrorism to mass demonstrations, deliberately unarmed, will confront us with challenges that are not so simple, close quote. It's an emerging media theme also that Palestinians are now, as the New York Times had it in an April piece, trying a less violent path to resistance, though Ethan Bronner at that time wrote, quote, nonviolence has never caught on here, close quote. And the Times' Joe Klein, just to add to that, has written that the Palestinian movement has been defined by terrorism and has never been known for dramatic acts of nonviolence. And he quoted Kenneth Pollack of Brookings saying, if they'd been led by Gandhi rather than Yasser Arafat, they would have had a state 20 years ago. What do you make of the notion of nonviolence as a new approach, but then also of this idea that we will see a change in Israeli tactics?
Well, this is, you know, it's such a fabrication and such a blatant ignorance of Palestinian history. And I'm so pleased now that there's a new book about this that we can point people to. Mazen Qumsiyah's new book called Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment. We just reviewed that on the Electronic Intifada. But this book is so important because it puts the current struggles in the long history of Palestinian nonviolent resistance dating back to the 1930s and before. And, of course, the first Intifada in the late 1980s, which was an unarmed uprising to which Israel responded with brutal force. And the second Intifada, you know, beginning in 2000, where we forget, of course, thousands and thousands of deaths ago, but beginning in September 2000, that something like 60 Palestinians had been killed before a single Israeli was killed at the beginning of the second Intifada. And again, the media not noticing that overwhelmingly the violence runs in one direction. You know, you look at the statistics, just the simple statistics. Since January 1st, 2008, the number of Palestinians killed in conflict-related violence, mostly killed by the Israeli military, but some by settlers as well, is well over 2,000 people. That's not including many, many thousands of injured people. The number of Israelis killed in conflict-related violence is under 70 in the same period of time. So again, we get this reversal where, you know, Palestinians are portrayed as the violent ones and Israeli violence is rendered invisible or excused, or you simply have the falsification of chronology to make it look like Israeli violence is always merely a passive response to Palestinian instigated violence.
Well, the Nakba coverage did much of it refer to international support for the border protests, sort of tying them to the Arab Spring. I wonder, finally, if you see any change in the way these protests and the rights of Palestinians are viewed. And in keeping with that or not in keeping with that, what did you make of Barack Obama's speech that you have just heard?
I think if this was supposed to convince an Arab audience, there was really little in it that's going to change perceptions. Take the issue of nonviolence. Once again, Obama was explicitly telling Arab people they have to have nonviolence, when just a couple of days before, on Sunday, May 15th, thousands of Palestinians, in fact, tens of thousands, marched nonviolently for the right of return in Lebanon on the occupied Golan Heights, and Israel shot dead more than a dozen of them, and we didn't hear a single word of condemnation of the fact that here are Palestinians taking up the call to nonviolence en masse, that the response is violence, and the United States, in fact, endorsed Israel's response. So really, there's nothing new here.
We've been speaking with journalist and author Ali Abu Nima. Find more work on these issues on the web at electronicintifada.net. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
You're very welcome.
FAIR, the group that produces Counterspin, celebrated its 25th anniversary on April 28th at New York City's Symphony Space, with a show that included remarks by Salon's Glenn Greenwald, Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, writer and activist Noam Chomsky, and filmmaker Michael Moore. Today, we bring you a portion of Glenn Greenwald's talk, including his signature media criticism. Here's Glenn Greenwald.
The first political controversy on which I focused intensively was the NSA eavesdropping scandal in 2005. Literally weeks after I created a political blog, the New York Times revealed that the Bush administration for years had been illegally spying on American citizens without the warrants required by law. As it turns out, the New York Times actually knew about that illegal program for over a year. They learned about it in mid-2004, but the editor, the executive editor and publisher of that newspaper, was summoned to the Oval Office and told by George Bush not to reveal that information, and they dutifully complied and didn't inform Americans of this illegal program until after George Bush was safely reelected. But I guess if one wants to be generous, one can say better late than never. And so in 2005, they revealed this warrantless eavesdropping scandal, and I began working on it very intensively. And I actually thought at the time that this would be a relatively straightforward and simple political scandal. What I actually believed, and I say this with some embarrassment over the naivete under which I was laboring, was that other than some Republican partisans, some hardcore Republican loyalists, that there would be a consensus, given that George Bush had just got caught red-handed doing exactly that which the criminal law says that you are barred from doing, which is eavesdropping on the telephone calls and emails of Americans without warrants. I thought that there would be a consensus that, at the very least, that was a bad thing to do. That it's just not a good thing when anyone, including the president, violates the criminal law enacted by the American people through their Congress. I literally expected there to be a consensus that that would be a bad thing and that there should be consequences. And not only did that consensus not arise, in political and media circles, including in the liberal precincts of the liberal media, the opposite consensus quickly ossified, almost immediately, which is that George Bush did nothing wrong in spying on Americans in violation of the law. And in fact, the only people who were acting improperly and who deserved approbation were those, the handful of people who were shrilly and recklessly suggesting that George Bush had committed crimes and ought to be investigated for those crimes. That was the consensus that immediately arose. And illustrative of that media consensus was a column in January 2006 by the longtime celebrated liberal writer of Time magazine, Joe Klein, who Peter just mentioned. And in this column, Joe Klein sternly warned Nancy Pelosi and all Democrats not to criticize or object to Bush's illegal spying program, because if they did, they would be perceived as soft on terrorism and it would cost them the midterm election in 2006. And besides that, Bush was only doing this because he was trying to protect us all from terrorism, and it would be terribly unfair of Democrats to politically exploit that controversy for political gain. Now, I do find Joe Klein to be a valuable member of the establishment media because of how illustrative he is. He's been held out as the liberal pundit for years as he's been writing things like this. In 2002, Joe Klein, the liberal pundit, wrote a scathing article in The Guardian in which he denounced the European left for the terrible and outrageous slander against the United States, the defamation, he called it, against the United States, because the European left dared to suggest that there might be some detainee abuse at Guantanamo. And Klein wrote this column, and he called that suggestion, quote, total rubbish. And then he wrote this about Guantanamo detainees, and I quote, I would actually prefer they be dressed in pink tutus to give them an appreciation of the freedoms accorded Western ballerinas. So that was what the liberal pundit was saying in 2002 about Guantanamo. That was a few months before he went on Meet the Press and argued that it was a moral and strategic imperative for the United States to remove Saddam Hussein from power through the use of military force. And that was a couple of years before he went on ABC News and argued that the United States must actively consider, as a response to Iran's nuclear research, launching a first strike nuclear attack on Iran. And that was about a year before he wrote a column demanding that President Obama not subject those nice CIA agents who had participated in the creation of a worldwide torture regime to any form of investigation, because he wrote, and I quote again, the CIA CIA is often asked to behave extra legally for the greater good of the nation. That's the term that our political and media class uses for high-level lawbreaking, that they act extra legally, not illegally, extra legally for the greater good of the nation. So that was Joe Klein, one of the great liberal commentators in the liberal media, standing next to other lions of liberal commentary, such as the Washington Post's Richard Cohen, who, after Colin Powell went to the UN in 2003 and waved around a couple of plastic vials filled with white powder and showed some blurry satellite photographs with very technical-looking arrows pointing at various things, Richard Cohen, the liberal Washington Post columnist, went to the newspaper and wrote, quote, "The evidence Powell presented to the United Nations had to prove to anyone that Iraq not only hasn't accounted for its weapons of mass destruction, but without a doubt still retains them. Only a fool or possibly a Frenchman could conclude otherwise." That was Richard Cohen's view at the time of George Bush's foreign policy. And then those two commentators are joined in the great pantheon of liberal commentary by Jonathan Alter of Newsweek magazine, who enjoys the profound distinction, which nobody can ever take away from him, of being the very first media figure to publicly and explicitly, in the wake of 9/11, advocate that the United States use torture. That's what he did in a November 1st, 2001 Newsweek column entitled, appropriately enough, quote, "It's time to think about torture." And this was his first sentence. Quote, "In this autumn of anger, even a liberal can find his thoughts turning to ... torture." So that's not Fox News producing all of that. That is the predominant liberal punditocracy in the United States, and they were every bit as emphatic in their refusal to condemn George Bush's eavesdropping program as being illegal and criminal as their right-wing counterparts were.
That was Salon's Glenn Greenwald speaking at FAIR's 25th anniversary celebration at New York City's Symphony Space on April 28th. If you're interested in getting a DVD of the show, which also includes Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, filmmaker Michael Moore, and author and activist Noam Chomsky, you can get details about that on FAIR's homepage at fair.org.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.